The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction and fantasy. I am your host, Beverly Prentice. I hope you enjoy the program. If so, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com. Tap, Tap, Tap by Ian Gonzalez. We don't go past the hatch, ever. I stand before Mal, hands shoved in the pockets of my worn jumpsuit, a sullen glower on my face. Maybe if we did, we'd know why our world is falling apart. For as long as anyone can remember, we've lived here in the habitat section. We don't know where we came from, who put us here, or why they did it, and no one seems interested in finding out. Mal scowls at me. No one believes that, Wit. Our world is just fine. The habitat section has lasted this long. It will keep going. The machines will see to that. Whatever's wrong, they'll fix it. The machines. They've been around as long as anyone can remember, too. Squat metal boxes on wheels, sprouting armatures. They trundle up and down the corridors, poking and probing, doing maintenance, keeping things running, we're assured. But every so often a machine stops moving. Sometimes other machines come by, make it start moving again. Sometimes they don't. I shake my head. It's getting worse, Mal. Now this noise has started and we don't know what it means. Mal's frown deepens and he opens his mouth, but before words can come out, the sound comes again. Tap, tap, tap. 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 Tap, tap, tap. It seems to emanate from the very walls, a sharp metallic sound echoing and reverberating up and down the corridors. Tap, tap, tap. 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 Tap, tap, tap. It doesn't mean anything, Mal snaps. It's just another noise, like the air blowing through the vents or the hum from the generators. I sigh. Mal is the first for this term, elected by a full vote. He makes a good speaker. He knows what to say. To keep people calm and content, he knows all the regulations by heart, and he's never questioned any of them. Unlike me, I look around now at the small crowd clustered farther back up the long corridor, afraid to get too close to the hatch, afraid to get too close to me. Most of the 5,000 or so people in the habitat section know about me. I'm the one who was caught poking around in one of the stopped machines. I'm the one they found taking apart a system's maintenance panel when its lights stopped glowing and the machines didn't do anything about it. I'm the one who asked why we never go past the hatch. This is different, Mal, and you know it, I say, trying to sound reasonable. It's part of the problems. How many machines have stopped just in the last few cycles? How many of the generators have stopped humming? How many of the agriplots have stopped producing food? We need to do something. Wit, you need to stop thinking like this, Mal says, his own voice taking on the warm, patronizing tones he typically uses first. Sure, a few systems have stopped working like they used to, but most of them are doing just fine. We still have food, we still have heat, air, light. He gives me a smile. We're fine. Tap, tap, tap. Tap, 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 tap. It's as if the noise is mocking his comforting words. Mal's smile goes a little fixed, making it more like a grimace. We're going to do what we always do, Whit. We're going to follow the regulations. He turns and points at the sign on the hatch, the one that's always been there. It's a little faded, a little worn, but still clear and easy to read. No unauthorized access. No one's sure exactly what that means, but according to the regulations, it means we're not supposed to go past the hatch. So we don't. But the tapping is coming from past the hatch. So someone must be out there. So I know what I have to do. Okay, Mal, I say, slipping a false grin onto my face. You're right. We'll be fine. We'll obey the regulations. We won't go past the hatch. I wait till the dark half of the cycle, when the lights automatically dim, and people retreat to the common spaces or their cabins. I make my way down the long corridor, every step taking me closer to doing what might turn out to be the stupidest thing I've done yet. The regulations exist for a reason. I know this. They tell us how to keep ourselves alive and safe. They're what's kept us going for so long. But things are changing, and I must know what it means. The hatch isn't guarded. It never has been. Everybody knows that nobody would be foolish enough to open it. Even Mal wouldn't believe I could do what I'm about to do. I step up to the panel beside the hatch, with its glowing green light and many colored buttons, all faded and chipped, their labels so worn they're hardly readable. Here I hesitate. Once I do this, there's no going back. I have no idea what I'll find on the other side. Maybe I'll find out what happens when you break the regulations. Or maybe I'll actually find answers and learn how to fix our world. My breath comes short and fast, and I feel hot and cold and prickly all at once. Should I do this? Can I do this? Tap, 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 tap. That decides me. I press the button labeled open. A series of metallic clanks rings out, frighteningly loud in the dim stillness. There's a hiss of air forced through a tight space, and groaning and creaking, the massive hatch swivels open. With a last glance over my shoulder, I step through. My first thought at seeing what lies beyond the hatch is disappointment. This side looks a lot like what I just left behind. The long corridor just seems to continue. Sure, the lighting overhead is dim, a few of the glow panels flickering unsteadily, but that could just be because of the time of the cycle. It's also a lot dirtier. Dust lying thick on the floor, the walls streaked with residue of leaked fluids and patches of rust. It's clear that no one has been here in a long time. I take a few tentative steps, moving away from the opening. A second later, the hatch starts to close behind me. I have a moment of panic, worried that I won't be able to go back. I even start to move to throw myself through it before it can close. All thoughts of discovery and exploration are nearly abandoned. Tap, tap, tap. Tap, tap, tap. Tap, tap, tap. The noise holds me back, roots me in place. I can't give up so easily. I need to know. So I turn my back on the hatch and start walking. The long corridor lives up to its name. It just seems to keep going and going. I realize that it must follow a curve. I can't see the hatch anymore, and I can't see an end in sight. There's nothing behind me but a trail of my footprints through the dust. It's all very strange. What sort of a place is this? Signs and markings adorn the walls, partially obscured by the dust and dried fluids, eaten away by the rust. I can read the words, but they don't make sense. Secondary life support. Genetics Lab Alpha, Outer Ring Observatory. What do they mean? There are more hatches, lots of them, but they won't open. No little green lights glow on the panels next to them. Most of them look as corroded as the walls. Others are even worse. One is all bent, bulging out into the corridor, like something hit it from the inside really hard. Another is dented and scraped all around the edges, reminding me of the time someone damaged their locker and tried to pry it open. As I pass one of the hatches, I see the metal is covered with a layer of frost. The air around it's so cold, it steals my breath and makes my skin hurt. I don't even want to know what's beyond that one. It feels like I've been walking for hours, days, forever maybe, just walking down this long, long corridor, past sealed hatches and corroded walls, feet scuffling in the dust and echoing through the emptiness. Maybe everything is like this. Maybe there's nothing to this place outside the habitat section. Maybe it's all a dead metal world except where we live. And maybe our part of it is just catching up to the rest of it, dying slowly. I slow, then stop, look back the way I came. Maybe I should just go home, listen to Mal and hope that things get better again, even if I know they won't. Maybe I should just let everything end. Tap, tap, tap. Tap, 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 tap. That noise, it's like it knows where I am, what I'm thinking, like it needs me to keep going. So I keep going. Finally, something changes. I see another hatch just coming visible around the gentle curve of the passageway. For a second, I don't know what's different about it. Then I see on the panel beside it a glowing red light, like a baleful eye peering through the gloom. That's different. I step up to the panel, eyeing the red light warily. My hand reaches out, finger hovering over the open button. What lies behind this hatch? Will I find what I'm looking for? Will it even open for me? I press the button. Nothing happens. No grinding or whirring. No crack and hiss of a parting seal. No opening. I sigh, disappointment swelling. It looks like I came all this way, broke the regulations for nothing. My little exploration will end here without any answers, without any way to know what's going wrong with my world. Then a soft beep sounds, and the light on the control panel goes from red to green. The hatch opens, groaning and squealing in protest, whatever mechanism powers and moves it clanking and grinding. It doesn't make it all the way, seizing up with a loud thud and a sputter of sparks from the panel, but it's open enough for me to slip through the gap. I take a deep breath and go through. What I find on the other side is not what I expected. The walls and floor of the corridor are warped and blackened. Many of the panels peeled away, showing wires and conduits behind them. Most of the glow panels are shattered, littering the scarred floor with shards of plastic. Frayed and broken wires spark and sputter, while damaged pipes and conduits spray jets of mist. There's a constant hiss of escaping gases, and the air is thick with a haze of smoke, creating a foul, acrid stink that burns my throat. Something terrible has happened here. For a long moment, all I can do is stand there, wondering anew if my quest has been a waste of time. How could anyone live through this? How can I find any answers here? Tap, 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 tap. It's the same sound that drew me here, only different. Now it's constant. Just a continual tapping, echoing through the metal of the walls. I listen for a moment, then take a few tentative steps into the devastated corridor. The tapping increases in speed, as if telling me I'm doing the right thing. I follow it. I wend my way through the destruction, crawling under or scrabbling over collapsed wall panels and buckled flooring sections. Carefully, I edge around sparkling wires and jets of gas, some of which are very hot, others bitingly cold. In places, open flames dance across pools of spilled fluid, forcing me to leap over the flames. The smoke in the air gets thicker, making it even harder to breathe. And always, there's the constant, insistent tapping. When I come to a place where two corridors meet, I pause. I cough, eyes watering, trying to decide which way to go. I take a step to the left, but the tapping stops. So I turn the other way, and the tapping resumes. Now I know something is watching me, tracking me. It knows where I am and where it wants me to go. But do we want the same thing? Well, it's not like I have a lot of options. I follow the tapping. I come to another hatch, one that looks in better shape than any other I've seen. As I approach, it opens, just enough for me to slip through. I do so, gratefully, eager to escape the caustic air and heat of the damaged area. On the other side, it looks a lot like home. Everything is neat and clean. The lights are working normally. The air is cool and fresh. The signs on the walls are clear and unobstructed. The one nearest me reads, Medical Facility. I wonder what that is. There's only one way to go, so I go that way. Within a few feet, the corridor opens into a chamber, with strange machines lining one wall and a row of clean, neatly made beds on the other. The tapping, steady up till now, grows even faster. Unconsciously, I move more swiftly forward. Whatever is making the sound is close by, and I'm eager to find it. Around a gentle curve, I come across a section of wall that's made of clear plastic, revealing what lies on the other side. It's the strangest thing I've seen yet. More of the strange machines surround what looks like a bed, only it's propped upright. Weirder yet, there's someone in the bed, held in place by straps, wrapped in white sheets of fabric so that only the head, shoulders, and arms are visible. Tubes and wires connect the person to the machines, which beep and hiss and tick as they do whatever they're supposed to do. Above the sheets, I see a face. It's a person, an old woman. Soft brown eyes stare at me in something like wonder, and a smile forms on her lined face. Hi there, she says. Oh, it's so good to see another person after all this time. Hi, I say back. Were you making that tapping noise? Yes, she says. One arm moves, drawing my gaze to a length of pipe roughly broken off at one end that she holds in her hand. I'm glad you followed it. Comms are down after accident. I know members of the control group aren't supposed to leave the habitat, but I hope someone would be curious enough. She breaks off into a fit of coughing, body pressing against the restraints. I frown. Are you all right? Why did you need someone to come here? She draws a ragged breath. Listen, there's no time to explain everything. We're on a space station. She shakes her head, forestalling my next question. I know you don't know what that is, but we're above Earth, the world our predecessors came from. They had to leave it centuries ago while the cleanup was carried out. Long story short, it's finally ready. We're in the last stage of the project. I'm its director. I'm supposed to handle the resettlement. Strange words and strange ideas are coming at me faster than I can handle them. I don't understand. I know, but I just need you to listen to do what I tell you. Can you do that? I suppose, I say with a shrug. I guess I'm not the best person for just doing what I'm told, though. A fleeting smile crosses her face. I picked up on that, see? I've been monitoring the habitat for years, making sure you were ready. Then the accident happened. My colleagues were all killed, and I was, well, you can see. So I've been trying to initiate the resettlement remotely, only there's been too much damage. That's where you come in. I need you to do something for me. She coughs again, and blood flecks the window between us. Okay, what? I've encoded a new set of regulations, instructions. They'll get the remaining machines to start the resettlement. And convince your fellow settlers that you've been right all along. Her expression changes, becoming soft and apologetic, like she's telling me something she's not sure I'm ready to hear. Everything is going to change, Whit. You're going to go home, to your real home, and you're going to have to start everything over. It will all be strange, a new experience. You'll have to explore and discover, and it'll probably take your whole life, but it will mean that future generations will have a better life. And maybe, just maybe, this time around we'll get things right. I hear her words over and over again in my head. New experience. Explore. Discover. For the rest of my life. I can honestly say I've never been more excited. I meet her gaze and smile. Just tell me what I have to do. The Last Voyage of Commander Jenkins by Lawrence M. Bates. I open my eyes. It's light out. Then something that sounds like a Chopin nocturne starts ever so softly to intrude upon my still half-awake, still half-asleep consciousness. I begin stretching to get the kinks out, only to find my elbows banging against the side of my crypt. Oh, yeah, right. I'm Joshua Jenkins, the captain of the starship Montmartre, on a colony prep mission. All the hoses and med devices and such have been retracted from my body, and the lid to my pod has been popped open by Roslyn. Hallelujah! That means we're in orbit around Kiriyoki 3, and it's time for me to snap into action. It also means, as the realization suddenly dawns upon me, that I'm still alive. The revival protocols kick in, and I sit up to self-check for brain fog and atrophied muscles. The Advanced Life Support Hibernation Module, ALSHM, a.k.a. Crypt, a.k.a. Pod, is supposed to handle all the biological necessities for us while we're in stasis. It must have worked, because I actually feel pretty good. This must be my lucky day. I step out of the crypt without any wobbling, and sure enough, over in the corner, right where I left it, hangs my captain's uniform. It's a red jumpsuit with an insignia that reads Commander Jenkins. But by my lights, the starship is still a sailing ship, and I'm still this ship's captain. After getting dressed, I finally notice it. According to protocol, we're all supposed to be reawakened at the same time, in case something goes wrong and someone needs help, but the pods of my three-person crew remain unopened. I walk around the crypt room and inspect each pod. They seem to be operating normally, with all vitals showing in the green. Something must be wrong. Rosalind. Yes, Commander Jenkins. I can't resist. Would it kill you to call me Captain Jenkins instead of Commander Jenkins? You know I hate that. No, Commander. Calling you Captain Jenkins instead of Commander Jenkins will not result in my death or in any way disrupt my power supply. Did you enjoy the Chopin-themed revival procedure? That was one of the last orders you gave me before entering stasis. Ah, yes, that was fine. Good. That means that that aspect of me is still functioning properly. What the hell? Rosalind, why did you revive me and not the others? Aren't we in orbit around Kuroki 3? No, Commander. I encountered an anomaly which requires the Commander's attention. Please proceed to the bridge. I have a brief waiting for you there. Okay, on my way. Wow, a problem that needs human intervention. Scratch that. Commander intervention. As I walk down the corridor, my mind starts racing as to what kind of anomaly would short-circuit a ship mind. It's supposed to be able to autonomously handle just about any contingency that the universe can throw at it. I'm used to Roslyn and her eccentricities, but now I'm starting to get a little nervous. I reach the bridge doors and am admitted by Roslyn. Roslyn, as you can see, I'm here. What's going on? The main viewing screen pops into life. Shows a simulation of the Montmartre as it travels through space from Earth towards Kuroki 3, a journey of some 320 light-years. As the Montmartre gets to about 20 light-years from its destination, the simulation freezes. For 6 months, Rosalind begins, the voyage of the Montmartre has proceeded without any significant incidents. Then 2 days ago, the ship attained zero velocity and remains immobilized with respect to this sector of the observable universe at the location indicated by the red pulsing dot on the screen. That's impossible, I say. You can't just stop in space. Agreed. What has happened to the Montmartre is impossible. I have spent the last 2 days checking my systems for faults, but have found none. All my instruments report optimal functionality. I have tried using the attitudinal thrusters to maneuver and change our position, but to no effect. I then tried restarting the latent drive on low power to see if that could get the Montmartre moving. But our position remains unchanged. Somehow, we have been frozen in place, and I have been unable to formulate an explanation, let alone a remedy for this phenomenon. In a case such as this, default protocols demand that I revive the commander and seek human assistance. I'm so shocked by this that I almost fall over backward before managing to recover my balance. Now I need to recover my emotional balance. 2 months behind us is the Red Swan, carrying thousands of colonists expecting to wake up and move into a makeshift habitat that we're supposed to have already prepared for them. Will they get stuck here too? My psych profile says that I excel at inhibiting panic and focusing on problem solving. That's one of the reasons why Space Lab made me a ship captain. More importantly, my psych profile also goes on to state that I've been evaluated out as a high IQ, ultra-rational sociopath who doesn't interact well with other human beings in what is classically referred to as a mentally healthy manner. This serves to amplify my predilection to make decisions based on mission priorities and not personal relationships. In other words, Space Lab made me a starship captain because I'm a first-rate, well, you know, and everyone else knows it. Rosalind, something must be wrong with your senses. This just can't be happening. Yes, Commander Jenkins, either I am broken or the universe is. I instruct Rosalind to try slowly revving up the engines to full power. We don't move either backward or forward. In fact, alarms go off as the engines start overheating. Commander Jenkins, I must turn off the engines or they will explode in 17.3 seconds. A latent drive explosion is not anything you want to be around. I wait another few seconds just to make sure, but nothing changes. Rosalyn, power down the engines. Yes, Commander Jenkins. I then order Rosalyn to revive my crewmates and instruct them to assemble in the dining room in 2 hours' time, giving all of us a chance to settle into wakefulness. Arriving a little early is Padak Ramanotra, a physicist. Tall, lanky, even regal in bearing, he grabs himself a coffee and sits down at the table. An attempt at small talk is made while we wait for the others, but it's soon abandoned. Oddly, when we talk physics, we get along just fine. Thankfully, a few minutes later, Susan Orman and Lee Sung wander in together, chatting amiably. After all, they're expecting this to be a pre-planning session for exploring and colonizing Kiryoki 3, and are excited about finally getting the opportunity to do just that. Orman specializes in exobiology, and so is by nature a bit quirky and somewhat whimsical. That's okay with me. Space Lab must consider these desirable personality traits in a person that you're expecting to be able to communicate with alien beings. Sung is a planetary scientist. Her disposition sours as she takes a seat and realizes that she must put up with being in the same room as me, at least for the time being. Understandable. Deep space exploration is not kind to fools, and back on Earth during training, I rode her pretty hard while I took it relatively easy on Ramanotra and Orman. She noticed, and at one point she just flat out said that she hated my guts. In my standard charming style, I responded, "Lots of people hate my guts, so don't think you're anything special for it." Sung just humphed, obviously unimpressed with my wit. As long as she does her job and follows my orders, then I don't have a problem with her. We'll see. All three possess multidisciplinary scientific skills, and all three of them are a lot smarter than I am. And boy, do I need their expertise now. Padak speaks first, asking, "Where's Kiryoki 3? I don't see it on any of my screens. Shouldn't we be in orbit around it?" At that point, I explain to them the nature of our predicament. As expected, a chorus of, "That's impossible," resounds through the dining room. Then I sit back and wait for the information to sink in, and for them to start ideating. Susan asks, "Did you check Rustlin's logs?" "Yes," I say. "Not in detail, but I didn't offhand see anything unusual. 1 minute we're cruising along at latent 12, the next minute we're at zero. Or at least according to Rosalyn. Rosalyn's been running diagnostics for the last 2 days, and I hasn't found anything wrong. That's why she revived me. She doesn't know what to do, and neither do I." Paddock starts thinking out loud. "Okay, assuming that Rosalyn is right, here's a few ideas that could explain the stoppage. 1, we've entered a black hole. 2, we've entered a void, a nullity, a region of non-universe where there's no space for us to travel through. Or 3, and this is a long shot, maybe this region of space is the result of 2 inflation fields from 2 different universes intersecting each other, resulting in a patch where the laws of physics that we are used to no longer apply. Rogue black holes are a real problem in deep space, akin to the icebergs that our earthbound seafaring ancestors had to contend with." I said, "Rosalyn is designed to detect gravitational anomalies and asteroidal debris and make the appropriate course adjustments. As I said to Susan, a review of the logs contains no indication of any significant course corrections or major incidents encountered during our journey. As for a space void, that's something we'll just have to find a way to test for. During this back and forth with Paddock, Orman and Sung have been whispering to each other. Now, apparently satisfied, they look at me and then each other, deciding which one of them is to present the material. Of course, it's Orman who does the talking. Here's what we think. It could be flypaper or a spider web. That's a bit much even for me. That would imply that some creature is going to come along at any moment and eat this ship along with us in it. I reject that explanation because, one, it's too far-fetched for me, and two, if it's true, we're done for. I don't see how the Montmartre can fend off some gigantic galactic starship predator. Orman continues without missing a beat. Okay, if you don't like that explanation, how about this one? It's a border wall, or perhaps a border sphere. Some alien races like their privacy, and this is their cosmic beware of dogs sign. Huh. I never would have thought of that. Leave it to an exobiologist to come up with an anthropomorphic interpretation. Or it could be asteroid protection, adds Paddock. Even though there are no planets anywhere near here that would need protecting, still, who knows? All that sounds plausible, I say, but it's an asteroid protection shield. Why are we stuck here? And if it's a border wall, are they studying us? Vetting us before allowing entry? We continue in this vein for another hour or so. One option, of course, is to just go back into stasis and wait to see if something ever comes along to either eat us or collect us for an alien museum. Even if the wall is a naturally occurring phenomenon, subject to dissolution over time, that may be ongoing for millions of years, everyone, including myself, agrees that going back to sleep without knowing what's up is a non-starter. Besides, we sign up for these missions because we want to explore, not sleep. Sung finally finds her voice. You know that you have to notify the Red Swan and tell them to go back to Earth. Yes, I reply. Being overall mission commander gives me the authority to override anyone and anything. I could just advise the Red Swan of our situation and order it back to Earth and dump the problem back onto Space Lab's lap. I've refrained from contacting them yet because I don't want to have to abort the mission until we're positive that we have no other choice. Eventually, we agree on a game plan that hopefully will lead to our getting out of this mess. Meanwhile, the Red Swan is still barreling headlong towards our position. Are they doomed to suffer the same fate as the Montmartre? We spend the next 3 days running tests. If it is one of Paddock's voids, then I can't take the risk of exposing someone to this unknown environment. So first, we have a robot shove a probe out of the airlock. Surprisingly, the probe is able to maneuver around the vicinity of the ship freely. Also, we are able to confirm some cosmological constants such as the speed of light via the probe and Rosslyn's instrumentation as well. So it doesn't appear that this is some kind of nullity. Feeling adventurous, we next try extending the probe's radius of exploration. We extend the range to a few 100 kilometers in all directions, up, down, left, right, backward, and especially forward. No problems. Paddock suggests that the wall is mass-sensitive. To check this out, I take the shuttle out for a spin, just in case the wall is life-form-sensitive. My spacesuit stays on in case the shuttle gets stuck and I have to hitchhike back to the ship. I take the shuttle out 1,000 kilometers in all directions and encounter no difficulties. The germ of a rescue plan begins to form in my mind. But I'm going to need Rosalind's help first. I return to the ship, go to my cabin, and lie down. Rosalind.
Yes, Commander Jenkins.
Is there a way for the shuttle to rendezvous with the Red Swan before it gets stuck here as well?
No, Commander Jenkins.
Why?
A message to the Red Swan ordering it to shed velocity will take approximately 4.4 weeks to arrive. That gives it approximately 2.5 weeks to match the shuttle's velocity for docking and then set a course for return to Earth before getting stopped by the wall. There is no way the Red Swan can slow down enough or the shuttle travel fast enough to meet the Red Swan at that critical point. Now it's my turn.
Rosalind, if the shuttle is located a safe distance away, would the shock wave generated by a latent drive explosion boost the shuttle to the velocity needed to be picked up by the Red Swan and also leave enough time for it to reorient itself on a course back to Earth before hitting the wall?
Ah, purrs Rosalind. She spends a few moments performing astronomical calculations.
Yes, Commander Jenkins, that is possible. The optimum scenario has a latent drive explosion that would actually propel the shuttle past the oncoming Red Swan as it slows. This gives the Red Swan ample time to turn around, build up speed, and recover the shuttle on its way back to Earth. Another pause. Commander Jenkins, you understand that in order to detonate the Montmartre by overheating the engines, you must be physically present in the bridge to override my safety protocols.
Yes, Rosalind, I understand. I assemble the crew once again in the dining room, explain to them my plan. They shuffle uncomfortably in their chairs for a moment, and then Paddock says, "To be truthful, Commander, the three of us have also come to the same conclusion. We just never believed you would approve it."
Well, consider it officially approved. You have 1 hour to pack your shuttle with your personal belongings along with a couple of weeks' worth of food. The sooner you launch, the better the odds are of your rescue. Get moving. While the crew is off busily packing, I make my way to the bridge. Rosalind pre-programs the shuttle's flight path. I send a data packet to the Red Swan's ship mind. It orders the revival of Commander Strasburg as well as containing all the maneuvering instructions needed to avoid the wall, rendezvous with the shuttle, and return to Earth. There's nothing to do now except wait for the crew to finish loading the shuttle. The intercom crackles. Commander Jenkins, we are ready for launch.
Very well, I tell them. Rosalind, launch the shuttle. Let me know when they're in position.
Yes, Commander Jenkins. The intercom crackles once more. It's Sung. Commander, I just wanted to let you know that I still hate your guts. I can't tell if she's being serious or getting sentimental on me.
Good, I reply.
That means you won't experience any psychological damage from this incident. The connection goes dead. I've got some time to kill, so I kick back, relax, and put my feet up on the console. Rosalind, play the Chopin piece.
Yes, Commander Jenkins.
I try imagining what it must have been like for seafaring explorers of the past, like Cook and Columbus sailing off into uncharted waters and unknown dangers. After some time, Rosalind interrupts my reverie.
Commander Jenkins, the shuttle has now reached a safe position.
It's time.
Oh, well, the captain always goes down with his ship.
Rosalind, disable all safety protocols. Bring the engines up to full power.
Aye, aye, Captain.